coming, everyone. I'm very pleased to welcome for this afternoon's seminar Dr. Rembert Leutjehans. Rembert did an Indology degree focusing on Sanskrit at the University of Leuven, or Louvain.
Kent.
Completely wrong. and did a DPhil here in Oxford. And he's one of our academic team here at the centre. And he's our librarian as well. And he wrote a very interesting thesis on a Vaishnava theologian who was also a poet-theologian. And he's not going to tell us about him today. He's rather going to speak about Jiva Goswami today. And the title of his talk is Tasting God, the Ascetical and Mystical Theology of Rupa Goswami.
It's actually about Rupa Goswami.
Your thesis?
No, my talk.
Oh, your talk is, that's what I said. Did I not say that?
No, you said Jiva Goswami, because that's what's...
Oh, Rupa Goswami, yes, I do apologise. Yes. Just showed you I should get my facts right before doing these introductions.
No, it says both, actually, there's a mistake in...
Ah, it does, it says both, so I'm not wrong. Well, he's going to just tell us about one of them.
Okay, in 1514, two men met in Ramakeli, a town not far from Goda, the ancient capital of Bengal. One of them was Sri Krishna Chaitanya, the charismatic saint who was once a teacher in Navadvip, the important seat of learning in Bengal, but who a few years earlier had been initiated as a Dashanami sannyasi and had renounced his academic career and his young wife. Chaitanya, who had by then settled in Puri in Orissa, on the east coast of the Indian subcontinent, was headed for Vrindavan, the place of Krishna's youth, when he stopped in Ramakeli. He was 28 years old. The other person was a 44-year-old Brahmin, whose family hailed from Karnataka in South India, but had moved to Bengal a few generations earlier. Up until this point, he worked at the Muslim court, where he was the Dabir Khas, or the personal secretary, of Nawab Hussain Shah, the local Muslim ruler. He would soon become known as Rupa Goswami. We actually don't know what his, at least I don't know what his real name was, his birth name was. Rupa was the name Chaitanya gave him at the first meeting, and Goswami is a title he received, but I actually don't know what his real name is, sort of his legal name, if you want. Before their meeting, Rupa and his brother Sanatana, who also occupied a high ministerial post at the Muslim court, had corresponded with Chaitanya, and when they heard he was en route to Vrindavan, they invited him over to their hometown. The meeting was to be a very significant one, for Rupa personally, but also for the intellectual history of Hindu thought. Rupa quickly renounced his position at the court and gave away most of his wealth, enough to fill several boats, the Chaitanya Charitamrita, one of the classical hagiographies of Chaitanya, tells us. When Chaitanya was on his return from Vrindavan, Rupa travelled west to meet him again in Prayag, in Allahabad, where Chaitanya taught him for 10 days. Rupa wanted to follow his master to his monastic residence in Puri, but Chaitanya ordered him to travel to Vrindavan, where he should write books on devotion and develop the town as a place of pilgrimage by building temples. In Vrindavan, he was quickly joined by other disciples sent by Krishna Chaitanya, all very intellectually gifted men. And most people know of them as the six Goswamis, but there's actually a lot more people than the six Goswamis. You have an intellectual hothouse that is sort of generated there. Soon, a new largely Bengali community formed, which Rupa and his elder brother Sanatan led in trying to fulfill the desires of Chaitanya. And so, with the support of local leaders like Raj Man Singh, the Amer ruler, who was Akbar's general and who Akbar himself called my own son, so they kind of got these people involved and supported them in building temples. And so, with the support of local leaders like Raj Man Singh, they began to build temples and develop the theology of Chaitanya's growing school. And it's often these two tasks that Chaitanya gave his followers in Vrindavan are seen as sort of separate things. That one is, basically develop the town where Krishna is said to sort of have grown up, to develop that as a place of pilgrimage by building temples and so on, and the other being, you know, to write books on theology. But I don't really see them as separate, and the more I think about what they were doing there in Vrindavan back in the 16th century, the more I realized that what they were really doing was they were creating a court culture. And Rupa and Sanatan Goswamis, they came from a court culture. They came from a Muslim court where they were employed as Brahmins. And several of the other people that go there have sort of a courtly connection. And it's really they're trying to establish a court culture in Vrindavan, with the only difference that there's no king. And the king is Krishna. The king is the image in the temple. And you get all this talk about Krishna being the king of Raja, and Krishna being the sort of, he's worshipped as a king in the temple and so on. And that's why, anyway, you'll see that the types of works that were produced in Vrindavan at that time were really works that traditionally were produced in courts, particularly the whole poetry, it's courtly poetry. Anyway, so I see the two as really integral, and you cannot sort of pull them apart. That for them, this was one and the same thing. Establishing temples was for them establishing a court, and at court, what you do, there's a whole intellectual culture at court and a whole poetic culture at the court, where the poetry is in praise of the king traditionally, and here the poetry is in praise of Krishna, of the image in the temple. Rupa Goswami was a prolific author. He wrote exclusively in Sanskrit and Prakrit in drama. Before his meeting with Chaitanya, he had already composed several poetic works on Krishna's play. The Dhanakela comedy, I have some of them here just to show you. This is the Dhanakela comedy, it's a short play. He composed before he met Chaitanya. And there's another one, the Hamsadutta. He most likely composed before he met Chaitanya. And shortly after his meeting with Chaitanya, he began to write his two biggest dramatic works, the Vidagdha Madhava, there you go, and the Lalita Madhava, which we have here. Just so you have some idea of the scope and the size of his library.
Are they translated?
Some of them.
Right.
Some of them. Well, there's a nice translation of the Hamsadutta, actually.
Do you have books on grammar? Vidagdha Madhava.
No, Vidagdha Madhava, it's a play. It's a nataka. And Lalita Madhava, too. It's a play that he originally intended to be one play and then later divided into two. He wrote a number of shorter poetic works, which were later bundled by his nephew Jiva Goswami as Stavamala, a garland of prayers, as well as a second Dutta Kavya, like the Hamsadutta, the Uddhava Sandesha, which you have. He compiled an anthology of devotional verse, the Padyavali, and also wrote some works on literary theory, the Nataka Chandrika, which you have here. That's not very long. And the very short Birudavali Lakshana. This is about drama, a theoretical work about drama. This is a theoretical work about Birudas, which is they're poems of praise, generally for a king, which Rupa Goswami and his follower and sort of the other members of his school wrote a lot of Biruda Kavyas, again, sort of suggesting that the courtly theme. And also a short work, which I don't have here, on a lexicographical work, the Prayukta Khyata Manjari, which is very, very short. One thing that's interesting, it's a lot of poetry. Everything except those two works you have here, but all this is all poetry that he wrote. And it's, again, poetry was composed at the court. It was a courtly activity. But kavya is also not easy. Kavya is considered It's learned poetry, and it's not for the masses. And it's something that you're supposed to have had an education in grammar, mimamsa, and logic before you would start studying poetry. And it's, you know, in poetic manuals you get a long list of everything a poet should know, and it goes from statecraft to sciences of works on horses and elephants and works on poetics and grammar and mimamsa and logic and all that stuff. So it means, you know, this was, Rupa Goswami was a very learned person, and this is kind of, yeah. But it also shows his interest. His interest was really poetry. And he had like many of the other members of the movement, he sort of becomes part of, the interest was, there was a lot of interest in poetry, for reasons I won't get into now. But that is important for the next set of works and for the rest of the paper. His most famous works, however, are his theological works. The Lagu Bhagavatamrita, a shorter work which sets out his complex avatar theology, and his two works on devotion, the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which you have here, and the, this means the ocean of the sweet essence of devotional rasa, and its sequel, the Ujjvala Nilamani, the blazing sapphire, which is this work. In this paper, I will mainly look at the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which Rupa Goswami completed in Vraja in 1541. The work was not published, however, until the end of the century, and there's some dispute about when this was, either in the 1570s or in the 1590s, as his nephew Jiva Goswami kept the work and edited long after Rupa passed away. So the effect of Rupa Goswami's works, he actually did not see. He wrote the work, and it was sort of known in the circle in which he lived. But then Jiva Goswami, his nephew, was editing the work and didn't complete that until long after he passed away. And so the work was not disseminated until after his death, really. It was not published until he passed away. The Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is a very influential text. Many later works of the Chaitanya tradition build on it or are based on it, particularly those of Vishwanath Chakravarti, an important Chaitanya Vaishnava theologian of the 17th century, who wrote several works based on the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, like the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu Bindu, the drop of the ocean, and the Madhurya Kadambini, which is basically a commentary on a few verses of the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, and a few others. But his ideas also surface in the writings of other schools, and this is mainly in contemporary authors. You'll find Rupa Goswami's ideas, you'll find them in taken up by authors of other schools, of non-Gaudiya schools, and without attributing them to Rupa Goswami, can they sort of just assume that this is how you think of devotion, and this is how you, how everyone thinks about devotion, and how everyone thinks about Krishna. Okay. This lecture is part of a seminar series on comparative mysticism, which we started here at the OCHS about a year ago. A wide variety of speakers have already spoken on mysticism or mysticisms in Christianity, Islam, and Buddhism, most of which I unfortunately missed because I wasn't here. And I was asked to say something on Hindu mysticism. I immediately thought of speaking on Rupa Goswami, as he's a fascinating figure who attempted to rethink religious experience. Though he has not been the main focus of my research for many years, I still find myself repeatedly revisiting him. And so he seemed a good person to speak on for this lecture series. And I told Gavin I would speak on Rupa Goswami's ascetical and mystical theology. And I'll talk a bit later about why I want to include the ascetical part and why it's not just mystical theology. They're terms, of course, from Catholic theology. Ascetical theology is the theology of practice, basically, of spiritual practice or religious practice, and mystical theology is the sort of law of mysticism, I suppose. And so, I was going to speak on Rupa Goswami, But that was nearly 6 months ago when I was asked to do this. A few weeks ago, as I started to think of what to say today, I realized this wasn't as easy as I thought it would be. What exactly do we mean by mysticism, which these seminars are supposed to compare or at least look at from a comparative perspective? And that's a whole another debate in itself. What is mysticism? And I won't get into this here. And more importantly, what exactly would Rupa Goswami understand by that term? Or to put it differently, what term in Rupa Goswami's theology could be translated as mysticism? When I arrived in Oxford several years ago to study for a DPhil in theology, another member of the theology faculty asked me what exactly my area of study in theology would be. Dogmatic theology? Patristics? Or what? Hindu theology, I answered enthusiastically, to which he shot back, Hindu theology? There's no such thing. Do they even have a word for theology? And that last question stayed with me all those years. You know, do they even have a word for theology? I don't agree that there is no, with this person, that there is no Hindu theology. But the question, do they even have a word for theology? That's something that stuck with me. And as I was preparing for this, I started to think, well, does Rupa Goswami have a word for mysticism? How does he conceive of it, of what, you know, sort of is broadly considered mysticism in a Western context, perhaps? Perhaps the best equivalent for the term mysticism in the Hindu context, and particularly in the context of Rupa Goswami's ideas, is the term bhakti, derived from the Sanskrit verbal root paj. Monier Williams gives a long list of possible meanings: to share, partake of, enjoy, experience, to serve, to honor, love, adore, and so on. The term is generally translated as devotion, sometimes devotional faith or faith, and sometimes as love. At the very beginning of the Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu, Rupa Goswami defines bhakti, or rather, the highest bhakti, the Uttama bhakti, and he doesn't really say anything about. You suppose that if there's a higher bhakti, there's a lower bhakti, but he doesn't say anything about that. Anyway, this is his definition of Uttama bhakti, of the highest bhakti. The highest devotion is dedicated service to Krishna that is rendered pleasantly, is devoid of desire for anything else, and is unobstructed by intellectual knowledge, jnana, and purposeful action, karma. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, the leader of the Hare Krishna movement, who comes in Rupa Goswami's line, always translated bhakti not as devotion, but as devotional service. I think this is quite an apt translation and fits Rupa Goswami's concept of bhakti, for it stresses not just the emotional dimension of bhakti, but also its active nature. Bhakti is not just a sentiment of love, but also an action. Those bhakti texts will often talk of doing bhakti. You have bhakti that is often used with the verb kur, to do or to make. You have kurvanti ahaitukim bhakti in the Bhagavata, that they do bhakti, which is sort of doesn't have a cause, causeless. And Rupa Goswami similarly in several places talks about doing bhakti, which is kind of heart with an emotion. You don't do love, or you don't do anger or something like that. Rupa Goswami conveys this idea in his definition of bhakti with the word anushilana, dedicated service or constant practice, which Jiva Goswami, his nephew, explains in his commentary on this verse as consisting of both actions, cheshta, and emotion, bhava. This is significant for two reasons. First of all, for Rupa Goswami, bhakti is generally not just an internal emotional state, but one that translates into some action. The only exception to this is Rupa's understanding of tranquil or peaceful devotion, shanta bhakti, in which the devotee has a vision of God, but does not partake or even witness God's play, God's leela. But more importantly, devotion does not just refer to the union with or experience of God, or in other words, to mysticism, but also to the practice of devotional acts that lead to that state. In other words, in defining bhakti as Rupa Goswami does, he also stresses that through external actions one can come to the internal emotional state. Hence the subtitle for this talk, the ascetical and mystical theology of Rupa Goswami. And it's really, in Rupa Goswami's thought, you cannot separate the two. The two are both are called bhakti. So the state of practice, sort of the realm of ascetical theology and the realm of mysticism, is both called bhakti for him. And it's kind of a... they're, you have to consider them as a whole, and both are quite interesting. And so that's why Rupa Goswami says that it's dedicated practice. It's a dedicated service. It's not just about the emotions, but it's about the action. And furthermore, whether in its perfected state, and it's kind of the ascetical and mystical part. In Sanskrit, we have terms for that. It's called sadhana, is the ascetical part, and sadhya is the mystical part, if you want. Sadhana is that which leads to a goal, and sadhya is that which is to be obtained, literally. So, furthermore, whether in its perfected state, in sadhya, or in the state of practice, sadhana, devotion is for Rupa Goswami of an exclusive nature. It cannot coexist with other motives or emotional states. Hence, he states that devotion is devoid of desire or devoid of ambition for anything else, and it has to be unobstructed by karma and jnana. Rupa Goswami does not say karma and jnana. Karma is, of course, literally action, and jnana is literally knowledge. But Rupa Goswami understands a particular type of action, a particular type of knowledge in it. And of course, there are terms that are used in other Hindu traditions, karma, particularly in ritualistic traditions, where you perform rituals and for a particular purpose, and jnana, particularly in the Advaitin traditions, that Rupa Goswami and his school kind of reacts against, where it's about knowledge and knowledge of the sort of the ultimate reality of everything, and you obtain a state of pure awareness, and by which you then sort of attain liberation. And so there's a lot of stress on liberation and on a detachment from this world, because you realize this world is impermanent and so on. And Rupa Goswami and his commentators particularly stress that the karma that has to be given up, that cannot obstruct bhakti, is not just action in general, but it is action, this is Haberman's translation, purposeful action. It's action for a particular fruit, to obtain a particular thing. And the jnana that has to be given up, the knowledge that has to be given up, it's not knowledge in general, but it's the knowledge of the Advaitins, the undifferentiated knowledge of Brahman. And Jiva Goswami, in his commentary, he stresses that knowledge of Krishna is necessary for bhakti. So it's that type of knowledge should not be given up. And it's kind of clear as you read these authors' works, they are very learned. They do have lots of knowledge. And they stress knowledge a lot. And then finally he says, it should be pleasantly performed, which means it should be performed for the satisfaction of God, not for your own satisfaction. And later on in the Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu, Rupa Goswami comes back to this, that the purpose of devotion or of bhakti is not for your own satisfaction or even for your own liberation and to become free from suffering, but it's for the pleasure of God. And as long as there is this self interest involved, this desire to be happy, even if it's to be happy in the service of God or in sort of union with God, it is not pure yet. Rupa then divides devotion into three stages: sadhana bhakti, or devotion and practice; bhava bhakti, devotion with emotion; and prema bhakti, devotion with love. The bulk of the Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu's first section of four, deals with sadhana bhakti, whereas the rest of the work, three very long sections, are devoted to an analysis of bhava and prema bhakti in a theoretical framework borrowed from Sanskrit literary theory. And we'll come back to this in a moment. The Because of the nature of the work and the way Rupa Goswami thinks of bhakti, the work is quite a unique work. And because at some parts it seems like you're reading a ritual manual, sort of a classical Sanskrit ritual manual, where you get a long list of various practices and verses praising, you know, generally from the Puranas and Pancharatra texts, praising those actions, that by doing this you obtain, you become free from all suffering. By doing this you obtain the highest abode. By doing this the sins of your forefathers are sort of washed away, and so on. You get all these praises of all these practices, but then as you go into the later sections of the work, it really looks like you're reading a work on literary theory. In Sanskrit literary theory, it's the essence of a literary work is its emotional content, and so you get a whole analysis of emotions in the Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu that can be experienced in relation to God. But the way he analyzes it is like the literary theorists do about emotions in literary works. And so it's a bit of an odd work in that, it's sort of a unique work in that sense, because it's sort of, you go from a ritual manual, which tend to be, at least they're always characterized in by the authors on poetics as really dry and boring and dull. And then you kind of are sort of swept away into a totally different style of work, where you get where it's all sort of literary theory, basically, or so something that looks like literary theory, where it's all about emotions and feelings and so on. It is also important to keep in mind that Rupa Goswami is not a philosopher. He rarely argues for his ideas and merely states them. He's not kind of his nephew Jiva Goswami, who writes commentaries on his works and then expands his ideas in his own works. He's more of a philosopher. He argues for his ideas. Rupa Goswami just says, here it is, take it or leave it, kind of. That's his mode. In the beginning of the Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu, he even warns his readers not to approach the text as a logician. And there's a quote, "Even a tiny taste of devotion is tantamount to an understanding of the principles of devotion. While logic alone is not, because it is an unreliable measure of devotion. Therefore, the ancient teachers have said, a position that is asserted with even meticulous care by clever logicians can be proven to be otherwise by those who are even more clever." And this is a standard refutation of logic in Vedantic texts, that because you can establish something by logic, or because you can demolish something by logic that has been established by logic, therefore logic is not sort of, it's not conclusive, it doesn't lead to an end that of sort of a certainty, and it's particularly useless on its own to come to about knowledge of God, because logic is inconclusive, it cannot go anywhere. So Rupa echoes here the classical Vedantic attitude towards logic. When it comes to knowledge of God, logic is unreliable, apratishthana, literally having no foundation or without solid ground. And hence it should be grounded in revelation, in Shruti, which originates from Brahman and is the womb of it, Shastrayonitvat. Scripture gives birth, it's the womb of God, basically. Theology in the Vedantic context is thus largely hermeneutics. In the very beginning of his Laghu Bhagavatamrita, which is another work of Rupa Goswami, Rupa follows this reasoning, referring to the Brahma Sutra and to these classical texts, sort of stating this. But Rupa's approach in the Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu is slightly different, though. Rupa quotes numerous verses, probably about 40% of the entire text is just citations from other sources, from a wide variety of sources to substantiate his ideas. But particularly in the later portions of the text where he analyzes rasa, their role is very different from the profuse citations in Vedantic texts. They're not meant as so much to prove his ideas as they are to illustrate them. In this regard, the Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu resembles the method of the Sanskrit literary theorists, who will illustrate their theory with examples from other literary works or sometimes their own compositions. Indeed, a number of Rupa's citations in these later portions of the text are from his own literary works, the Vedanta and Lalita Madhava, the Dhanakela Kaumudi, the Uddhava Sandesha, and Hamsadutta, and his anthology of devotional verse. Basically, everything you have here is quoted, as well as a number of older poets, Bhartri Hari, Bilva Mangala, Jayadeva's Gita Govinda, Kula Shekhar's Mukunda Mala, and so on. And so that's kind of the nature of the text. It's sort of you go from ritual to literary theory in style. So he says bhakti devotion is of three types. There's three stages: sadhana, the stage of practice; bhava, the stage of emotion; and prema, the stage of love. Sadhana bhakti, the stage of practice, is meant to lead to bhava bhakti, which then transforms into prema bhakti. And Rupa Goswami writes, and here's a quote: "Devotion that achieves a foundational emotion, a bhava, through physical effort is called sadhana." That which leads you to emotion through doing something physically, that is called sadhana. Its goal is the manifestation in the heart of an eternally perfected emotion. This kind of devotion is mentioned by the divine sage Narada in the seventh canto. And there's a quote from the Bhagavata: "Therefore, by some means, the mind should be fixed on Krishna." There's a lot of important stuff in this simple verse. But it basically, the important thing is that he says it's the manifestation in the heart of the emotion which is the goal of your practice, that is nitya siddha, that is eternally established. So it's not something that is obtained from sort of something that is obtained from another source than yourself, but it is something that is inherent in you, and it's something that basically has to be reawakened. And Rupa Goswami says very little about this, actually. His disciples, Jiva Goswami and Krishnadas Kaviraj, they will develop this further and say a bit more about this. But the basic idea is that the bhava that you're meant to obtain, the emotion for God that you're meant to obtain, is not something external to yourself. It's not something that you have to get from another place. It's just something that has to be awakened. And so the process of sadhana, of practice, is meant to, as he quotes this verse, "Therefore, by some means, the mind should be fixed on Krishna." That is the purpose of sadhana. It's just to bring one's mind and one's awareness to God. And by doing that repeatedly, you'll come to an emotion. So it's by acting as if you love God, basically, you will come to love God. That's the idea. Sadhana is of two types: a practice that is motivated by the injunctions of scripture, or vidhi from vidhi, and then from injunction we get vidhi, and practice that, quote, follows passion, raganuga, wherein one is motivated not by the injunctions of scripture, but by passion. It is not entirely clear how these two relate to each other. Rupa's own comments have been interpreted in different ways by his followers. Is Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti a separate path that can be taken up independently of Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti? Or is the latter supposed to lead to the former, and a necessity to practice Raganuga? So in other words, you have these two types of practice he talks about. One where you're motivated by scriptural injunction, because the sacred texts say you should worship in the temple in this and this way, therefore you do it. Whereas the other one, you're not motivated by that, but you're motivated by passion, by sort of an intense desire, or sort of an intense sort of inner drive. How they relate to each other is unclear. You start with injunctions and then go to the sort of gradually get to the stage of passion, or not? Can you go straight to Raganuga, basically? I tend to think Rupa meant the former, that you start with one and then go to the other. But others have interpreted that you can go straight for the second one. And the important thing is to keep in mind is that they're both still at the stage of practice. Raganuga is not a perfected state. You do not have love of God yet in that stage. So you're still practicing, and as we'll see, there's quite a different set of practices. So the exact relationship is a bit unclear, but what is clear, however, from the Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu is that Rupa Goswami does consider that both of these practices can lead to the second stage, bhava bhakti, devotion with emotion. Though they give a different type of bhava bhakti, and he's very clear on that. He says there's, if in other words, you can be motivated by scriptural injunctions and obtain love of God, but it will be of a different type than if you're motivated by passion. What type of practice does Rupa prescribe? The first type of sadhana is a regular form of devotional practice found in all Vaishnava traditions. The devotee should approach a guru, become initiated into the worship of Krishna by him, inquire from him, worship Krishna in the temple, wear the marks of a Vaishnava, chant Krishna's names or meditate on certain mantras, go on pilgrimage, seek the company of other devotees, remember and meditate on God, pray, listen to narrations of Krishna's play, smell the incense offered to the Murti, and so on. And he gives a long list of various practices he should perform. Rupa also lists a number of things he should abstain from. He should give up the company of those averse to devotion. He should not undertake grand projects. Very interesting. He should give up excessive attachment to books, artistic performances, lecturing, and debates. And he should not be overwhelmed by worldly emotions like sorrow. And there's more that he gives. The devotee should also not be too renounced. Though renunciation and detachment come naturally to one engaged in devotion to God, Rupa warns that excessive renunciation kills devotion. There's a quote, "The saints generally believe that knowledge and renunciation cause a hardening of the heart, whereas devotion is said to be tender by nature." So therefore, careful on the renunciation, he says.
That's good.
The devotee should especially not renounce those things related to or used in the worship of Krishna. There's a quote, "When those who desire moksha renounce things that are associated with Hari, with Krishna," Rupa writes, "when they mistakenly understanding them to be ordinary material objects, that is called worthless renunciation. On the other hand, when a person is not attached to ordinary worldly objects and suitably engages such objects and uses them in a relationship with Krishna, that is called proper renunciation." So this is a sort of a reaction to the Advaitins who, you know, they renounce the world, but they renounce the worship in the temple and everything like that, considering them to be material. So he says, this is taking it too far. These things should not be renounced because they're not material. They're used in the service of God. Therefore, they're spiritual. And then there is the other type of practice, raga-anuga. This type of practice is less external and involves complex visualizations and meditation. The devotee follows or imitates a perfected devotee of Krishna, and through meditation and visualization, worships Krishna with that emotional disposition. And this is, again, it's a state of practice where Rupa Goswami says that there's a particular siddha devotee, a perfected devotee of Krishna that you're attracted to, that you like, and you take on their sort of emotional disposition, sort of their emotional feelings towards God, and you start worshipping God through visualization with those emotions, basically. And you start in your meditation, you start worshipping God as these people worship God, basically. And it's, again, it's a complex method of visualization, where imagine you yourself to have a different body than your body here, and you imagine you sort of visualize to have a body like the body of those who worship Krishna, and through that you worship. So it's, again, it's a whole set of practices. There's some who interpret this in an external way as well, where they say externally you should also act like those perfected But Rupa Goswami doesn't seem to go that far. And there's some Rupa Goswami says, well, the practices of Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, of worshipping Krishna in the temple and all these things, says they can be performed in this stage as well. So there is external things going on as well, but internally there's sort of a different meditation happening, and it's really a visualization practice. And Rupa Goswami is very brief actually on this, but you have other works that kind of elaborate how you should visualize these types of things. The practice of bhakti, whether the motivated by passion or scriptural injunction, leads to the attainment of bhava or emotion, which for Rupa Goswami really means love for Krishna. That's what for him bhava means, Krishna rati. And he defines bhava as a special form of the pure and luminous quality, and is like a beam of the sun of supreme love, prema. Its desirous rays soften the heart. And prema, which then bhava sort of transforms into prema, into the third stage. He says, when bhava softens the heart completely and becomes very intense, and when it is marked by a high degree of myness, it is called prema by the wise. And so the last two stages of bhakti for Rupa Goswami, they're basically they're transformations of each other. You obtain by practice, you obtain love for God, and that is the stage of bhava. And then when that love for God intensifies, it turns into prema. And that's why he says that bhava is a beam of the sun of supreme love. And so he compares it to when the sun rises. You first just see the rays of the sun, but not the sun itself. So that is bhava. And then when the sun is fully risen, then that is prema. The love is fully manifest. It's characterized by a high degree of mindness. So it's the devotee claims Krishna, claims God to be his own, basically. He says, he's my. And it's kind of this, you know, this idea of mindness. Is always looked on as something negative in Hindu texts. For Rupa Goswami, it's something very positive. It means you claim God as one of your own, basically, as God belongs to you. Through the intimacy that is created by the love between you and God. Those who have attained love for God are, according to Rupa Goswami, patient, use their time fruitfully, they're disinterested in sensual enjoyment, free from pride, hopeful they will attain God, filled with the longing for God, and delight in chanting the Lord's name, the praising of his qualities, and in the places where he dwells. Contrary to those who have attained the level of bhava, it is hard to describe the behavior of those who are absorbed in prema. And Rupa Goswami says, the behavior of that fortunate one in whose heart prema has newly manifested is difficult to fathom, even by those well-versed in scripture. So it's kind of, that's a realm of its own. You cannot even say how a person whose love is intensified into prema will act. Let's skip this. In order to understand Rupa's ideas of these two stages of devotion, of bhava and prema, we have to step into the world of Sanskrit literary theory, from which Rupa Goswami borrows his terminology and conceptual framework. And it's what Rupa Goswami does in analyzing these higher stages of devotion is he imports a whole conceptual framework from an entirely different realm, and he takes it from Sanskrit literary theory. And in Sanskrit literary theory, the essence of a poetic work, whether it's drama or later on just sort of versified written poetry, is emotion. Bharata says, "Nahi rasa adrite kashchidaita pravartate," that without rasa, without that special emotional quality, no meaning sort of comes forth. There's no point of a poem if it doesn't embody emotion. And anyway, that's a whole different realm, and we won't have time to really get into this in all its details. But to simplify it, you can sort of look at the Sanskrit literary theories as sort of coming, sort of as falling into two, I wouldn't say schools, but sort of two approaches or two interpretations of the whole rasa theory. And one is the older school, which their main question is, how does a literary work embody emotion? How is it that emotion can be developed in a literary work? Why is there emotion in a poem that just consists of words? And how is a poet developing emotions in a literary work? So it looks as rasa, as the emotional content of a poem, as internal to the work. You have another tradition which arises around the 10th, 11th century, which starts looking at rasa in a very different way. And their main question is not how does a literary work embody emotion, but why is it that I am moved by reading a poem? And how is it that words on paper or a performance on stage, how is it that that moves me? And how is it that I become, you know, by watching a tragedy, I become sad? Because I know what I see on stage is not real, and yet I'm emotionally affected by this. So how does this work? And so that's their concern of the later school. And basically, to simplify the whole discourse a bit there, the whole theory of whether of emotion and literature goes back to a simple phrase that we find in the oldest text on dramaturgy, which says "vibhava anubhava vyavichari samyoga rasa nishpati," that rasa, this particular emotional content, is nishpatis, is arises or is manifested by the combination of, and then you get a list of technical terms, of vibhava, anubhava, and vyabhichari bhava. And the vibhavas are really the causes of emotion. The anubhavas are the effects of emotion, the physical responses to an emotion. And the vyabhichari bhavas are the temporary emotional states that accompany an emotion. And so for love, for example, if you take, you know, take a Western example, Romeo and Juliet, Shakespeare's play. The emotion. Of course, there the emotion is. Let's take Shakuntala, the classical Sanskrit example. It's easier. It's about the love between Shakuntala, who's a girl, and the king Dushyanta. And so the emotion of the literary work is love. And the causes of love, of the emotion, are the characters, is Shakuntala and Dushyanta. They're the causes of the emotion. And the effects of the emotion are, if Shakuntala sees the king, she might, I don't know, smile or sort of be sort of run towards the king or whatever. There'll be a physical response of the emotion. And throughout the play, there's the main emotion, love, is accompanied by transitory emotional states, by temporary emotional states. So for love, for example, this can be anxiety, that you might be in anxiety about the love, about your beloved, that something might have happened to him, and so on. Or it might be anger when you get into a fight or something like that. And so the Sanskrit literary theorists say is that In a literary work, you develop emotions by doing this. So how can a literary work that's just words on paper or actors on stage in the performance, how can that convey emotion, or how can it contain emotion? Is by, if the poet depicts the causes of the emotion, the effects of the emotion, and describes the transitory emotional states that accompany the emotion, then there will be rasa. And rasa is understood differently by these two different approaches. One, for one, rasa is just an intensified form of that emotion, so that that's the view where rasa is internal to the literary work, where it's taken on, sort of developed in the literary work and reaches its climax, and that is called rasa. Whereas the other one is the audience sort of experiences something that corresponds to the emotional state of the characters on stage or in the literary work. If you watch a tragedy, you become sad. If you watch a comedy, you laugh and you feel happy. If you watch sort of a horror play, I don't know if there are any, you feel frightened and so on. And so that's the state, they say, that's called rasa, the emotional state that responds, or sort of emotional response to the literary world on stage. Now, what does this have to do with Rupa Goswami? He sort of imports this whole framework and says, this is a good theory, let's analyze religious experience through this. And so the bulk of the Bhaktisamrita Sindhu is just analyzing the different types of emotional states, the different types of causes, the different types of effects, the different types of transitory emotional states that accompany the main emotion. And what he's doing is very significant because, for example, basically what he's saying is in the world of devotion, it's a play, it's God's Leela. And in that play, there's one hero, and that is Krishna. And in his analysis in the Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu of Krishna, he uses all the technical terms used to analyze the leading man in a poem. And you know, you get these. Some of you might know this: is Dhira Lalita, Dhira Prashanta, and sort of Dhira Dat. They're all terms from Sanskrit literary theory in order to analyze the different types of leading men. And so he starts analyzing devotion through that, and saying that if you've attained the level of bhava, if you have attained the emotion of love of God, and then the causes of your emotion are present, and you physically have a physical response to the emotion within you, and there's some it's colored by some other emotional state, whether it's joy or anxiety or sadness or whatever, he says, then that becomes intensified and that turns into rasa, which is prema, which is a third stage of bhakti. Let's see. Does that make sense? Sorry, I'm getting into teacher mode now. And Rupa Goswami's his position is a little it's a little difficult to place him in either of these traditions, in either of these two approaches. One, which is rasa as internal to the literary work and just as the intensification of an emotion. The other, which is rasa as sort of inherent in the audience, which responds to a literary work. In general, his approach is that of the rasa is internal to the literary work. And it's the way he conceives of it is you basically become a participant in God's play. You're one of the characters in God's play, if you want. And by sort of going through the play, your emotions become intensified and reach that state of rasa. And there's something very significant about that state of rasa, because that state of rasa is always pleasurable. It's always something nice. It's a pleasurable feeling, even if the emotion it is based on is not pleasant. And so, for example, you get this whole discussion of love and separation. That's very prominent in this tradition, where you. You feel separation from God. You do not feel the presence of God, and so there's this intense anguish of not feeling the presence of God. And yet, because that becomes intensified and that turns into rasa, it is still pleasurable. It is not something that's just absolutely horrible. There's an element of pain in it, but there's a more important. There's an element of bliss, of ananda in it. And so that he takes from the older literary theory. And generally he's like that. There's a few places where he resembles more the later interpretation where rasa is inherent in the audience, but we'll get to that in just a moment. And Rupa Goswami says that literature, initially, and here he resembles actually the later school, literature is not essential for the realization of rasa. And that is something very radical to say, that he sort of takes this whole theory from literary theory and pulls it out of the literary realm. And he says later on in the Bhaktirasamrita Sanavi, here are a few verses that I'll read for you. Some scholars partial to poetry and drama, which are the literary theorists, are of the opinion that the involvement in poetry and drama about the Lord is the primary cause of the aforementioned aesthetic components. And so he says that there's those who say that these types of experiences can only be had by listening to a play about Krishna about God. And he says, however, the ultimate cause of the aesthetic components of all the vibhavas, anubhavas, and all that stuff is the power of love itself, which is the wonderful perfection of a sweetness that is beyond reason. The emotion called love shares in the inconceivable divine nature, the Achintya Swarupa, and its essence is a playful emanation of the great power, the Mahashakti. And this, and we won't get into this, but it's basically coming from God himself. That's the idea, from his own Shakti, from his own potency. As such, it cannot be validated by reason. And then he quotes the famous Mahabharata verse, Achintya Kaluye Bhava Natang Tarkena Yojayet, to bhavas, here he takes it in terms of emotion, to emotions that are beyond this world, the logic does not apply. You cannot apply logic to this. And so he says that the idea that you can only experience rasa in relation to literature, as the later school says, by hearing the performance of a play, I identify with the characters on stage, I experience their emotional state in the form of rasa, in sort of a generalized form, that does not apply for bhakti. And it is not that you have to go and watch a play in order to experience this emotion or this intensification of emotion that he talks about. But he does say literature is important for the beginners, for the initial, the inexperienced people. And so he says, in the case of an inexperienced devotee who has just experienced a young sprout of love, a poem or drama about Krishna may be somewhat effective in producing the excitants and other aesthetic components. So they become the objects of his emotion. He sees Krishna in the play or in the poem, and that awakens his love for Krishna. And that becomes intensified and then becomes this level of prema or of rasa. But he continues, but saints with a mature love experience rasa upon hearing about Krishna in the slightest degree. And in this case, the cause of the aesthetic components is clearly the powerful influence of their love. And here's a very important, very innovative idea of Rupa Goswami, in that normally the ideas, the way emotions work is that if I see my lover, I feel love for my lover. That's the whole idea behind rasa, that if you present the causes of the emotion, then the emotions will be sort of stimulated. If I see my enemy, I get angry, and the anger in me sort of is awakened. And then, I might, in the case of ancient Sanskrit plays, I might pull out my sword or something. That's the physical reaction to this. And whereas Rupa Goswami says, no, this is not how it works when it comes to devotion. Devotion, the power of love for God is so strong that it creates its own causes. In other words, even if there is no cause for your emotion, even if there's nothing that stimulates your love of God, your love of God is so strong that it will create those objects of the emotion. And you see this perhaps the best illustration of this is in the biographies of Chaitanya, of Rupa's teacher, where you get in his later, at the end of his life, in Puri, he's wandering around, and He sees the ocean at one point, and he goes, "Oh, this is the Yamuna. This is the river where Krishna used to play." And he becomes sort of, his love is intensified, and he becomes mad with love, basically. And later, he sees a sand dune, and he thinks, "Oh, this is Govardhan Hill. This is the hill Krishna lifted in his childhood." And the way the Rupa Goswami understands this is that what is happening there is the power of his love is so strong that the love creates the objects of the emotion. The love turns ordinary objects into objects of his love for God, and therefore they see God everywhere, and everything reminds them of God, and therefore their love is continually sort of stimulated, and they experience this this rasa. I'm running out of time, but and Rupa Goswami then says there's five main types of rasas, five main types in which this devotion can be stimulated, and they're a peaceful rasa where the love for Krishna is sort of a peaceful one or a tranquil one, where there is no stimulus in the sense of it just consists of a vision of God, where you witness, you have a vision of God externally or internally, he says, but there's no action going on either on your part or on God's part. There's just a vision and that's it, and that is a form of devotion that is stimulated and turns into rasa. But then later he says, well, then you have another form, which is one of servitude, where you become God's servant, and then you have another one where you become God's friend, and then goes on to God's parent, where you have sort of a parental affection for God, where you want to protect God. And this is the idea of mindness that I talked about earlier, that in the stage of prema, it is characterized by a high degree of mindness, where you consider God not to be it turns things upside down. You're not belonging to God, but God belongs to you. That's the whole idea, and so you can conceive of God as somebody you have to take care of, you have to sort of watch over and keep away from harm, and so it creates this intense level of love. And then finally you have the sweet sort of devotion, the madhura devotion, or the amorous devotion, where God is your lover. He has a whole list of secondary emotions as well, which I won't get into because we're running out of time. But the important thing about Rupa Goswami's whole way of looking at things is not just that he does something clever and takes an existing framework and applies it to a realm where it wasn't meant to be applied in, when this theory was created, as he does with literary theory and then applies it to religious experience. But rather is that he saw, and the system of rasa really works. It's a system that explains how emotions work and how emotions are intensified and how you can feel emotions for something sort of that is different from you. Why do I identify with Romeo and Juliet on stage, for example? Or as in Rupa Goswami's context, why do I identify with hearing, for example, the stories of the Bhagavata, which talks about the devotees that I don't know, I've never met, and that are sort of foreign to me, and yet I can be moved by them and feel something of their emotions they have for God. So how is that? And that, he says, that is true. Now he uses this whole rasa theory to explain this. And the important thing of that is, for him, it's an active state. It is not sort of a passive state, but it is something that the love itself is active. In other words, it will create a stimulus everywhere you go. Everything you see becomes a stimulus for your own love. But it also, the important thing, and this is particularly important sort of in contrast with some other forms of Hindu mysticism, if you want, is it's a very personal mysticism in Rupa Goswami. It's about a relationship, really. And I 6 months ago, when I was asked to give this talk, I gave the title Tasting God, and then when it was published Then I forgot about it, and then I saw it published, and I was like, actually, that's not true. That's not what Rupa Goswami is talking about, because he's really not talking about tasting God. Rasa is, it means, you know, it's it has the connotation of taste, and rasana means, you know, to taste. And but he's not about, it's not about tasting God. It's about tasting the relationship with God. That is what you experience. So you do not experience God so much as you do the experience with God, and that's of a very emotional content. And that is something, the emphasis on that, on the relationship, and the emotions of the relationship, and that is what you experience rather than God. That, I think, I mean, something that I find very peculiar to Rupa Goswami, where he doesn't say much about, you know, what the Advaitins or even other Vaishnava schools would talk about experiencing Brahman and so on. That's not his interest. His interest is really the experience of the emotions you feel for God, and that become intensified. There's a lot more I could say, and there was a lot more I was going to say, but we're running out of time. So,
thank you very much, Rinpoche. It's really interesting. Thank you. We've got 25 minutes or so for questions.
Thank you very much.
I was curious about the relationship between this being a drama, and Krishna's Leela in some ways being a drama, and it being reality. And here I'm specifically talking not about the stage of practice, but of perfection. So Yashoda is Krishna's mother. Is that a drama, or is it actually reality? How would Rupa Goswami perceive that?
I mean, Rupa Goswami has the idea that this is real, in a sense, in the spiritual realm, and this is real there. But there's another sense in which kind of the boundaries between what is real and what is not real are kind of, it's sort of a question that is not so important for Rupa Goswami, it seems, that if you listen to a play, or if you watch a play about Krishna, you know, say you watch a Ras Leela play in Vrindavan, as was being performed in Rupa Goswami's time, and so on. If you watch a performance like that, you know what you're seeing is not real. You know that the actors, that they're actors putting on a show, basically, and that the person playing Krishna is not really Krishna, and the person playing, you know, Radha is not really Radha, and so on. And so you're aware of that, but by the power of the performance, just like any other performance, you start seeing them as real, and in your experience it becomes real. And there's sort of a sense of, it doesn't matter whether this is real or not real, but your experience of it is as real. And that's what counts. And the same in your meditation, in your visualization, and so on, or in your remembrance. And in a sense, whether it's real or not is not a concern for Rupa Goswami. It's about the emotions are real, and that is the important part of it. And so there's a anyway, does that?
Yes. That's very nice.
In the example of the drama, in the worldly sense. So long as one is aware of the unreality of the characters, one cannot relish the rasa. So one identifies himself. So long as the drama lasts, he is not aware of it. So only then he can relish that rasa anubhuti can be possible only when in that stage.
Yeah, and that's what you have to get to. As long as you see it as unreal, as actors playing a part, you cannot enter the world of the play, and therefore you cannot experience rasa. You'll just see actors performing a play rather than, you know.
Abhinava Gupta explains this sadharani karna that way.
And that's one of the things, the sadharani karna, sort of a generalization, And it comes from Abhinavagupta. He talks about this. Well, it actually comes from somebody before him, Bhattanayaka. He's the first to talk about it. It's kind of this idea that you watch a play you perceive the emotions on stage because the poet and the actors depict the causes and the effects of the emotions that's enacted on stage and the transitory emotional states and so on. And so you become aware of the emotions of the character and you experience those emotions, but not in the same way that the characters in the literary work experience them. So I do not fall in love with Romeo or Juliet as Romeo and Juliet do. But I experienced something that is similar to the emotions on the stage, but it's generalized. It is not focused on an individual. So I experienced love in a generalized form, or sort of sorrow in case of a tragedy in a generalized form, or heroism in sort of the story of great kings in a generalized state. And Rupa Goswami takes this idea and says, well, this is an important idea because it explains how we can identify with characters or in a literary work, whether they're real or not, that's sort of irrelevant. But we can, why do I identify with, say, Prahlad in the Bhagavata, and why do I feel a certain sort of emotion that Prahlad seems to be feeling in the story? And that, he says, that's through the process of generalization. It becomes a generalized state, and you are able to identify with them. Because you do not have the same relation with the characters in the play as the characters in the play have, because you're not in the play. So if you take the story of Prahlad, that Prahlad is a particular relation with Krishna in that sort of story, and I do not have that relationship because I'm not Prahlad, but I can still identify with him and sort of feel some of his emotions through this process of generalization.
In fact, that is Shringara, Hasya, this Prem, Karuna, etc. The innate Ananda is experienced. Ananda Anubhava. They all promote to the experience of the Ananda of the Sahrudaya. Yes. That is why we again see, even if it is a tragedy, we experience the joy in it.
Yeah.
So it gives the joy, we experience the joy out of that emotion. So it is transcended, emotion is transcended in that stage.
I mean, Rupa Goswami's idea is a bit different, because he goes back to Bhoja and writers like that, where he, for him, it's the intensification of the emotion. So bhava intensified becomes prema. So the emotion intensified becomes rasa. But he uses this process of generalization to basically explain why we can identify with emotions of people other than ourselves, basically.
Does he anywhere cite Abhinavagupta in his?
No, it's when he talks about generalization, sadhanikarana, he says, and Bharata Muni says, and he quotes a verse that is not in the Natya Shastra, which talks about this sadhanikarana, but he attributes it to Bharata. But it'd be interesting to see what text he had.
I think he's very much influenced by Abhinavagupta's view.
The interesting thing is that Abhinavagupta was not known in Bengal at that time. It's through Mamata, through the Kavya Prakasha, that his ideas are known. But Abhinavagupta was not known in Bengal at the time.
But his Danyaloka and Natya Shastra's commentary, they're all very well read throughout the...
Not in Bengal at that time. It was through the Kavya Prakasha of Mamata which kind of has these ideas in it. The Dvanya Loka was known, but not Abhinavagupta's commentary, as far as I can tell.
This is. I'm not trying to bring down the tone at all. I'm actually trying to make a bit of a serious point, but. I know, Nick, you say, and I've experienced this myself, and he's experienced this. You go to a community event, Hindu community event, and they're doing the Ramayana play, and
Ravana comes out on the stage and he's on there for a few minutes, and all of a sudden these old ladies go up with umbrellas and start beating him, you know, and everyone's shouting from the audience, and it is actually, they are identifying that this is Ravana, the poor actor has to suffer everything the ire of these people. But is it the same principle in pantomime, which is essentially for children? You know, so every Christmas to put on all these pantomimes, but you're encouraging the children to identify with the characters as being real. So the characters coming out, you know, invoking emotion, and all the children saying, "Look behind you," look, and all these mantras that we. But it is. It seems like the same principle, although Rupa Goswami is talking about something more profound, going from bhava to love of God. But is it essentially the same?
I mean, you can apply. In terms of literature and performance, you can apply the rasa theory to any literature, any performance, really. I would say that has a narrative sort of content in, whether it's, you know, a pantomime or a movie. But the reason why they say you do not experience the emotions of the character, you know, you experience them as real, but the reason why you cannot experience the emotions of the character is because it would be inappropriate, they say. If, for example, you have a story of the Ramayana, and you have Rama and Sita are on stage, they say it would be inappropriate to feel the love that Rama feels for Sita, because Sita is a goddess. And so you cannot feel the same love that he feels for her in the story, and therefore you feel something that is sort of removed from them. But it's also it's you do not with a love story, you see this very well. You know, you do not love Romeo or Juliet. You do not fall in love with these characters normally, but you experience something sort of generalized from based on their emotions.
At the beginning, you were talking about how the Rupa and Sanatan established a kind of courtly mood of in Vrindavan, which seems at odds with the mood that you hear about of Krishna in Vrindavan as more intimate, simple, rustic, unsophisticated mode of worship, if you like. I just wondered how
they're
too
can. Well, court culture is of a particular type. I mean, what I mean by establishing a court culture is that, I mean, for one, the image in the temple is worshipped like a king. And, you know, a lot of the rituals are really kingly rituals. And a lot of the sort of symbols used in the ritual of the murti in the temple are royal symbols. You know, the white umbrella, that's only used for a king, but that's, you know, used in processions when the murti is taken out of the temple and is taken in procession. You know, there's supposed to be a white umbrella above it, meaning this is the king. That's sort of the what it symbolizes. The whole ritual of Abhisheka is basically consecration of a king and so on. But then the whole sort of particularly the poetic literature that is produced is court poetry, and that was traditionally sort of written at courts by Brahmins who moved, sort of worked at the court and were patronized by the king. And they would compose poetry, some of it in glorification of the king, you know, basically sort of praising the king and saying that the king was the greatest king ever and conquered all his enemies and all sort such things, but also just writing plays for the amusement of the king and of the people at the court. So you'd have love stories that were performed at the court and so on, and that's what they're trying to do, and that's what they're doing in Vrindavan, except that there's no king, and the king is for Rupa Goswami Govinda, the murti he established. And so you get all this performance and this composition of poetry for the pleasure of the king, who's Krishna. And that's what they're doing. And, you know, yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah.
In fact, various offerings, the service done to the Shiva temple, the god in the temple, is mostly modeled on the core of the royal. We find the agamas with the same. So many rites, so many rituals, offerings, everything is modeled as a king's court and the offering offered to the king, beginning from early morning service to the night.
But the interesting thing I find about Rupa Goswami and the other people in Vrindavan at the time is that they were renouncers. Rupa Goswami had a very high position at the Muslim court, renounced it, gave up all his wealth, and moved to Vrindavan, where he lived as a beggar, basically. But then they have this interest of creating this whole courtly culture, the poetry, the immense buildings, the arts, the architecture, and so on, to create that all there, while being mendicants, basically, which is something very unique, actually, and particularly the whole Kavya side of it is something very unique for the time, where the profusion of, I mean, if you look at the first generation after Chaitanya, the literary works that were produced or written, most of them are poetry. It's the vast majority of the works that were produced was all poetry, and not so much theology, actually. Jiva Goswami does theology, and there's a few other people, but they're in the minority, really. And so there's this enormous interest in creating that, and that comes straight from a court culture.
I was also curious about your point on imagination, this is you're saying in the stage of practice there's the stage of Raganuga, where you're imagining yourself in a particular role. So I was wondering how much is that imagination could be based on one's physical circumstance. So if you're a little boy, you would imagine yourself as Prahlad, as the role model for a little boy. Mm-hmm. Or if you're a parent, you may imagine yourself as a parent. So is this seen as a problem in Rupa Goswami's theology? Mm-hmm. Or does the imagination need some sort of realization of divine embodiment or
he doesn't say much about that. I mean, the important thing is that he says it's motivated by passion, by raga, and so that is there. And so there's this intense desire to relate to Krishna in that particular relationship, therefore you start to visualize these things. Now, if you look at sort of the types of people who practice this type of meditation, it's generally fairly removed from who they are in real life. Often, they're men who are sort of visualizing to be a woman, and things like that. But Rupa Goswami himself doesn't say much about that. But it is once that passion is there, then you can take up this practice.
So following from Gopal's question, is it, you, in this practice, this visualization practice, these are you identifying with beings who are believed to be there, as it were? Or is it your double, as it were? Your double.
You don't so much identify with them as follow their modes of behavior.
So is it the sense that you have a deeper identity or a kind of another body, as it were, in the other realm? That's your deeper nature or truer nature.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of what comes out of this is you get this the practice and Rupa Goswami doesn't talk about it, and as far as we can tell, it doesn't seem to be going on in his time. But what you get later on is that you get initiated by a guru who basically sort of gives you a body in a sense and tells you, okay, this is how you should visualize it, and you're this and this person, and this is how you should relate to Krishna, and this is how you should meditate on it, and that's where you get the practice. Rupa Goswami himself doesn't talk about this at all, and in fact, one of the main reasons why I tend to think that he sees the sort of Raganuga as sort of a continuation from Vaidhi of the worship or the practice that is motivated by injunctions, is the fact that he doesn't say anything about a guru when it comes to Raganuga, where he does say a lot about the guru when it comes to Vaidhi, and given the importance of the guru in general, he kind of seems to say, okay, well, this is what's going on. You're initiated by a guru into the worship of Krishna, and you worship him, you know, in the temple and doing this and doing that, and then when the passion is there, then this is how you continue. I would suspect he would have said something about a guru if he really saw them as two distinct paths that you can take. He does seem to say that you can attain bhava without this special practice, but it will be of a different nature. But this visualization will lead you to a different type of bhava, to a different type of emotion.
Last question. How does Rupa Goswami conceive the ultimate realization of Krishna? By the self? By practicing all this up to the Prema Bhakti, after that, how does he attain Krishna? In what way it exists? In which relationship?
Well, that depends on he lists five relationships. So either as a servant, as a friend, as a parent, or sort of an elder, or as a lover. But it is, for Rupa Goswami, this is the personal form is the highest. So there's nothing beyond it, really. That's kind of the culmination of sort of re-entering the play of Krishna by obtaining this relationship with him.
Lover.
Yeah.
This would be fun. No, just to clarify, really, those five different rasas or relationships, are they like, I mean, five archetypes into which the different, when you spoke about Raganuga Bhakti, that you must emulate or follow in the footsteps of some scriptural personality, do they fall into those five categories, or like, I don't know, some transcendental Enneagram, five types?
He just lists two types. He says, you can do those who have an amorous relationship and follow those in your visualization, or kind of a few others who have a family relationship or a friend relationship, and that's the only distinction he makes. But the interesting thing, and that's where all this later debate comes from, that how do these two types of practices relate to each other, is that if you look at the chapter in which he talks about practice, it's probably about 300 verses in that chapter are about Vaidhi and all the rituals that you should do and so on, and then about, you know, 30 or so are on Raganuga, and you kind of, it's really brief, and you've just gone through a whole section of, and then there's this practice and this practice and this practice and this practice, and then he says, oh, and then there's this thing, this other sadhana that you can do, and before you know it, he's already done talking about it, and that it's over, and that's why there's it's sort of exactly what he means is sometimes unclear, because he doesn't say much about it. And that might be because he considers, well, this is something that the guru should, you know, sort of the tantric ideas, or it's esoteric, so you don't talk about it in great length. You sort of keep it a little hidden, maybe. Yeah.
It's interesting how he's both descriptive. He describes how human emotions are transformed into aesthetic emotions, which in turn, and then that's applied to the religious field. And that in turn becomes prescriptive in a sense well. So that's quite interesting there. Description becomes prescription. Anyway,
very quick clarification on the point that you made. You were talking about to have you're practicing you have a double in the spiritual realm, then you're practicing to achieve that double. But is that what he's saying? Is it that you're practicing to achieve a double, or are there other stages to go through, or I just think, you know, if is there a double of us? I mean, I would hate to achieve the spiritual realm and be me.
I'd hate to go to the spiritual realm.
Find yourself.
But you know, like, and maybe we're a duck in the spiritual realm or something like that.
Yeah, I'll bend your cross.
And that's fine if that's our real nature in the spirit. That would be perfect. And we'd be perfectly happy. Mm. But is it a defined thing? Is it, you know, because you say in the later tradition the guru actually explains something. Is he explaining exactly who you are in the spiritual realm, or is he explaining who you could start off as? Or I mean, is it cut and dry? Because otherwise, it begins to sound like Platonic kind of a thing. The perfect Eunice.
Yeah. I mean, Rupa Goswami doesn't say anything about that. He doesn't say, you know, whether you fall into one of these five things naturally or not, or whether you can say, oh, I kind of like this one, so I'll try for this one. He doesn't talk about it at all. He just says, well, there's these five types and that's it.
Probably that is decided by the guru. Mm. He identifies. Mm.
Well, that's the later tradition. That's
how he gives him the path, advises him.
Yeah, that's how it develops later on.
Well, thank you very much. Remember, we have to stop now, but that was really interesting and very thought provoking talk, I feel. So, thank you. Thank you.